All right, folks, we're done with vacation, and it's the takeaway for May 28th. The European Union Parliament elections have come and gone to mixed results.
Overall, what we're seeing is confirmation of a long-term trend, that we're seeing a much more fragmented European electorate than we used to.
Populist parties did well across the continent, but so did pro-Europe factions. Also on the show, with abortion constantly in the news, how parents are talking about it with their children.
I've been very open with her, kind of fact-based, and when she's asked questions age-appropriate, I've responded.
Plus, Disney's new remake of Aladdin does better on diversity, but is it doing enough? Wipe the cobwebs from your eyes, folks. We've got a lot of work to do. Let's get to it.
These European elections are a reflection on national politics.
It's to some extent a tragic joke.
Well, the main takeaway is that more Europeans voted in this European election than back in 2014.
We go on. There's voters about Europe, to change banks, agriculture, borders. Nothing is going to change within the Italian government. I just hope that after the election, our relationship with the Five Star Movement will be less confrontational.
The French people have put the National Rallies list at the top of the elections. I see a victory for the people who, with pride and dignity, took back the power tonight.
The majorities have been tied. The question of what does the Brexit entail has been very unclear. So I think it's important that the people in Britain decide which way to go forward.
Never before in British politics has a new party launched just 6 weeks ago topped the polls in a national election. The reason, of course, is very obvious. We voted to leave in a referendum. We were supposed to do so on March the 29th, and we haven't.
The European Union held its parliamentary elections over the weekend, and the results were mixed as the continent struggles to define its future. Nationalist and populist parties strengthened their place in European politics, but didn't do as well as expected. Pro-Europe parties did rally their supporters, who've been quieter in recent years, but did not reach a clear victory. And the established traditional parties took a backseat to smaller groups on the right and on the left. The unifying factor was high turnout, which hit above 50% for the first time in more than 20 years. In the United Kingdom, the results were a little more clear. The newly formed Brexit Party got the most votes, which means the Brits are sending representatives to the EU who believe that the UK should not be a part of the Union. Here to make sense of all these moving parts is Peter Hall, a professor of European Studies at Harvard University. Welcome to The Takeaway, Peter.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And also with us is Yasmin Sirhan, London-based staff writer at The Atlantic. Yasmin, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Yasmin, let's start with you. In the lead up to these elections, there were a lot of analysts who were predicting a surge in the far right and populist parties that did not seem to pan out. How well did far right groups do overall?
Yeah, it's true. There was a lot of hype in the lead up to this vote that effectively these populist far-right parties would continue the surge that we've seen in the last couple of years. Ultimately, some of them did do well. In France, Marine Le Pen's National Rally did come in first. In Italy, Salvini's League won. In Hungary, we saw Orban's party do well as well. But on the whole, as you said, we didn't see the surge that I think a lot of people were expecting. It was more like a fizzle. And even with the parties that did do well, like Le Pen's National Rally, she actually ended up losing some seats compared to the result that she had in the 2014 contest.
Peter, what about you? How do you view the far right performance, given all the rhetoric leading up to these elections?
Well, I think that's right. They didn't do as well as some were hoping and some were expecting. But I think the important message here is that rather than being a flash in the pan, they seem to be a grouping that's here to stay, at least for the foreseeable future. And of course, the other big news here was that the Green parties did very well in this election. And I think overall what we're seeing is confirmation of a long-term trend that the mainstream center-left, center-right parties that have dominated the European Parliament and also, for the most part, governed European nations over the past five decades. They're losing their grip on the electorate, and we're seeing a much more fragmented European electorate than we used to.
Yasmin, I'm wondering if you could comment on that, because I think that really what I'm taking away from this, and we'll talk more specifically as we go through the segment, is this, it feels like the EU is having an identity crisis of sorts.
No, I think Peter's absolutely right. We did see, I think, in this election, kind of two visions for the European Union kind of go head to head. A vision led by Salvini and nationalist far-right parties that wants to see the EU be a bit less powerful, for more of the decision-making to go to the nation states, versus a different vision led by Macron and others that wants to see a stronger EU. And in the end, we didn't really see an outright winner. I think Peter's right in saying that we're seeing a more fragmented politics in Europe, a type of fragmentation that we've actually even seen on the national level. I mean, we've seen this in Germany, where, you know, the mainstream parties didn't perform as well. So I think it's kind of rippling across the continent, but we're just seeing it on a big level here.
And I'm wondering, Peter, how do we explain, to Yasmin's point, the sort of the underperformance of some of the more mainstream parties in Europe?
Well, I think we have to admit that there's a good deal of discontent. Now, the causes of that are variable across the continent. In the south, the experience of austerity in the wake of the euro crisis gave a real boost to populist parties on the left. In Northern Europe, and indeed parts of the South, Italy a good case in point, immigration is a central issue. People are feeling that they're not doing as well as they used to. Significant numbers of Europeans say that life is going to be worse for their children than it is for them. So in some ways, certainly the vote for the populist right is a broad protest vote. On the other hand, maybe more happily, the vote for the Greens is inspired in some measure by this upsurge of support for environmental causes, to some extent the result of the strikes on Friday that school children have been mounting in Europe. And so the mainstream parties are losing votes both on their right flank to the populist right and middle class educated votes to the Greens.
Yasmin, we talked a little bit about the Green Party. I'm wondering, was there something specific in their message that resonated with Europeans?
Well, I was actually in Germany in the lead up to the European elections, and something that really stood out to me there was that the Green Party was really pushing more than just a climate argument, which obviously they're known for, but a pro-European argument. And we've seen that not just in Germany, but also in the UK, where the Greens performed quite well. So, I think they have a vision for Europe that is a stronger Europe, but also one that wants to tackle this issue. And so I think for voters looking for other parties, alternatives to the established ones, as Peter was just mentioning, that's kind of a positive message that hits two birds with one stone.
I want to get to the UK in a minute, but I do, Peter, want to ask you, since given the fact that there wasn't a specific ideology that really won out in the weekend's elections, does that tell us anything about the future of the EU's identity going forward?
Well, of course, the EU has had a permanent identity crisis, and I don't think that's going to end anytime soon. But I think it's very important to note that even though the populist right did relatively well, the balance of power in the European Parliament is held by pro-European parties. The Greens are pro-European. They want to see a somewhat different Europe, but they're pro-European. The Liberals, who did relatively well, partly because Emmanuel Macron's in France joined that group, they can join together with the center-left and the center-right and generate a broadly pro-European consensus. It'll be more difficult to generate than it was before, but it's definitely possible. Although I think all politicians in Europe are taking pause, if you like, at this movement on their left and right flanks and wondering, well, how far should we move towards greater European integration?
And I'm wondering, Yasmin, if you could weigh in here as well. It almost feels like the things that we're talking about, the Green Party, immigration, populism, these are things that are coming up in our little country over here across the pond as well. Are there any similarities in what you're seeing across the pond to what's happening here in the United States?
I mean, it is kind of interesting because, I mean, obviously, you know, the U.S. has a two-party system that I think is kind of different from European politics in that way that it sometimes feels like there's less options. But I do think you're right in that the topics that are of interest to people are very much the same. What'll be interesting to see is how American voters choose to voice their thoughts on these issues when it comes to the presidential election coming up. Perhaps instead of different parties, as the Europeans are turning to, perhaps they'll just turn to different types of candidates within the established parties themselves.
Peter, we've been sort of holding off on talking about the UK here, but the UK was also a big part of what happened over the weekend. What message did the British voters send in these elections?
Well, the main message they sent was one of unhappiness. They are very unhappy that Parliament hasn't been able to resolve the Brexit dilemma one way or another. Of course, there's variation in that unhappiness. I think this election confirmed that the British electorate is split right down the middle, essentially, between those who want to leave the European Union one way or another and those who want to remain. So this was a very sobering election for the two main parties, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party.
We also saw the news over the weekend, of course, that Prime Minister Theresa May was resigning. Yasmin, what does that mean for the UK and Brexit?
Essentially, I think the issue is that though Theresa May is stepping down, whoever her successor is going to face pretty much the same obstacles when it comes to the parliamentary division and deadlock that we've seen over the past few months and years. So whoever does end up taking her spot is going to be looking to these elections probably as a signal for where the country is and what sort of message they should be sending. And as Peter rightly mentioned, the result really told us what we already knew, that this country is very divided over the best way forward when it comes to Brexit. So ultimately, it will mean a new name at number 10. But I think the issues that they will face are going to remain pretty much the same.
And of course, we can't talk about this without talking about what all this means for us here in the United States. Peter, what do these elections signal for our relationship with the EU and vice versa?
Well, I think the success of the Greens and the populist right, at least limited success, is going to make relations with the U.S. a little bit more difficult. As you know, the Trump administration is in the midst of trying to negotiate a new trade agreement with Europe. That's on the back burner at the moment. China's on the front burner. But at some point, that will come back to the fore. And the Greens have been insisting and will continue to insist that any new trade agreements include significant measures on the environment, on climate change, on labor. The populist right, in turn, in Europe, are very keen on protecting European farmers, making sure that they face limited import competition. And of course, that's one of the central issues for the U.S. in these trade negotiations. So I think this is going to make the U.S. relations with Europe a little more difficult. And the other big issue for the U.S., I think, in Europe is Russia. Europe's on the front line vis-a-vis Russia, Ukraine, cybersecurity, and many, not all, but many of the populist right parties have been cozying up to Vladimir Putin. And that may make it a little more difficult for the EU in particular to take a strong line vis-a-vis Russia.
Peter Hall is a professor of European Studies at Harvard University, and Yasmin Sirhan is a staff writer at The Atlantic. We appreciate you both for being with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
Abortion has been a hard topic to avoid lately. A slew of recent laws have restricted abortion access in U.S. states like Alabama, Georgia, and Missouri. And parents, you told us about the conversations you're having with your children.
I told my children that if I hadn't had two abortions, I wouldn't have had them, but two other children. I'm pretty sure I told my daughters when they were in their teens.
I believe in a woman's right to choose. When my children became in their teens, I talked to each of them about a woman's right to choose.
Our kids are 12 and 11 years old, and my husband and I haven't really spoken to them about abortion, mostly because the topic hasn't come up. But we are both physicians and don't shy away from answering health-related questions honestly and appropriately for their ages.
I'm Heidi Bendick. I'm a mother of four, and I live in Orlando, Florida.
Heidi is one of many moms and dads who wrote to us at The Takeaway with their stories of talking to their kids about abortion as states roll back abortion rights. But her experience is not specific to the U.S.
My name is Taryn Devere. I'm a parent of five, and I live in Ireland.
Taryn lives on the border with Northern Ireland, where abortion remains severely restricted. So she's had plenty to discuss with her children, too. We brought Heidi and Taryn together to discuss the experience of talking to their kids about abortion. When national conversations around the issue are swirling around them, Heidi starts by talking about how her teenage daughter has reacted to the recent restrictions.
She really has reacted outwardly upset. She's a feminist and is not afraid to say that and admit that, talks freely about that with her friends. And this to her is very much a women's issue. And I think it has something that will spark a level of activism in her life going forward.
And Taryn, what about you? How do you approach the topic with your children, especially given the age differences between them?
So I consider myself to be a sex positive parent. So my style of parenting is to teach children about sexuality and gender and their bodies in a very kind of fact-based way from a very young age. So my children would already have been familiar with abortion in sort of age-appropriate ways from quite a young age. So when, when it became very much in the public eye was in the lead up to the Repeal the Eighth referendum last year. And so that was when I think a lot of people were having to have these kinds of conversations with their children because it was just everywhere. But in my case, I'd already had those conversations with my children.
Taryn, what about you? You have your own personal story that's impacted your feelings about abortion.
Yeah, I needed to have an abortion a few years ago, and at that point it was illegal in Ireland. So I guess prior to that I had been an abortion rights activist, but it became very stark to me, the reality of at that point we're in the Republic of Ireland, you were facing a 14-year prison sentence if you were caught having had an abortion or procuring abortion pills. We have a much worse situation only 20 minutes from where I live, which is across the border in Northern Ireland, which is legally part of the United Kingdom. And it's the only part of the United Kingdom where abortion is completely illegal and women actually face life imprisonment there. So it became much more stark for me. And once we had won repeal in the Republic of Ireland, now I'm joining the fight for the women in, and other people who can get pregnant in Northern Ireland to try and fight for abortion rights there.
Heidi, when we talk about abortion, it's not something we only talk to our daughters about. You have a teenage son as well. How are you talking to him about this issue?
We do talk about it. He has not asked as many questions or brought it up as much, but it has been a topic of conversation, you know, certainly with his sister and his dad. And I think he's unsure, honestly, how he feels about it. But we do talk openly about it. I think it's important for them to understand the history and how, you know, Roe v. Wade and where we are and what's kind of happening in this country right now with these states passing these different laws.
I have an almost opposite story to Heidi because my teenage daughter, while she was passionate about abortion rights in Ireland at the time of the referendum, and she did a lot of work in school around it, but actually my son, who was only 11 at the time, was probably the most interested of all of my children. And he actually became really very keen. And he would wear abortion rights badges to school and talk to all of his friends and informed all the kids in his class about abortion rights and why it was important. Mm-hmm. And when I was going to rallies and things, he would come along and he would bring a sign saying Kids for Choice. And, you know, he became a really sort of passionate advocate for reproductive freedom. So that was kind of funny that I had the opposite story to Heidi. But I think that in terms of consent and autonomy, that's stuff that I feel like really should be being taught to children from when they're babies, you know, from the moment that they can understand what parents are saying, because consent isn't a conversation you have with a 14-year-old or a 16-year-old. Consent is a conversation that you embed in your parenting from the moment your baby can understand what you're saying to them.
And then when you have the conversation about how consent impacts on sexual relations when they're teenagers, they're then fully able to comprehend this because they've had that grounding in body autonomy and respect for other people. So I think that's really important.
There's no doubt here that I'm sure in Ireland as well as here in the United States, the issue of abortion is a very polarizing issue. And I think increasingly more so with the very powerful visuals of women who dress up in handmaid's tale outfits and protest. I think, Heidi, when your kids encounter people who do support the laws that are coming through, who feel differently than you do about abortion, how do you prepare them for that? Because it's bound to happen.
Yeah, and it does happen. My daughter's in a debate class at school, and she's often one of the only ones that feels the way that she does about a variety of topics, but this one in particular as well. And she has found oftentimes that for this topic in particular, when she speaks up, she's labeled as a feminist, and she's owning that. You know, it was hard at first for her because she wanted to fit in, and she was afraid that it would create some kind of a negative reputation at school, but she embraces it and she owns it. And I'm proud of her for that. And it's not easy. Not every kid can or will be able to kind of keep their strong opinions when others disagree with what they're saying.
Taryn, what do you think is the most important thing to get across to kids about abortion right now? I mean, it's playing out here in the United States. It's played out in Ireland. As this continues to play out around the world, is there one thing you think kids have to know?
Yeah, I think that children, no matter what age they are, need to know that abortion is a very normal part of lots of people's reproductive health in their lives, and that it is very common. And it's also a good idea to try and tell kids some of the reasons why people might choose to have an abortion so they can develop empathy for people in those types of situations. So I think normalizing the fact that it happens so often and that it's needed and that it's just part of our healthcare is probably the key message.
Heidi Bendick is a mother of four in Orlando, Florida, and Taryn Devere is a parent of five and a writer and fashion activist based in Ireland. Thank you both so much.
Thanks so much, Tanzina.
I can show you the world, shining, shimmering, splendid.
Disney came out on top at the box office this Memorial Day weekend with its live-action remake of Aladdin that earned more than $230 million around the world. And although the movie is not a whole new world for viewers who remember the 1992 animated version, the film's casting does represent a new direction for the studio. While the original was headlined by white voice actors, the 2019 version mainly features actors of Middle Eastern and North African descent, of course alongside Will Smith, who's playing the genie. Here's Mina Massoud and Naomi Scott as Aladdin and Jasmine.
You should see these places. I mean, there's a whole world outside of books and maps. Do you want to?
How? Every door is guarded.
Who said anything about a door?
What are you doing?
Sometimes, princess, sometimes you just have to take a risk.
The film's initial success is a major win for Middle Eastern and North African representation on the screen, but the road to get here has been long and filled with stereotypes. Omar Mualim recently published a piece for The Ringer tracing the history of Middle Eastern and North African actors in Hollywood. Thanks for joining us, Omar.
Oh, hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me here.
So back in the 90s, you saw the original Aladdin in theaters. What were your memories of the original, and how does this current version compare?
Yeah, they were pretty vivid. It's the first time that I remember my family going to see a movie together, and you know, it was kind of a big deal in our small little Canadian town to know that Disney made a movie about us. And we largely felt kind of proud to be seen, but there were these little things that we picked up on that were kind of unsettling, and you know, there was these very like the exaggerated Arab features to the point of being grotesque on most of the characters except for Aladdin and Jasmine, and this conflation of South Asian and Middle Eastern culture. And then there was this opening song, this lyric in the opening song that says, you know, I come from a land of a faraway place where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. And it's barbaric, but hey, it's home. And it was, you know, it's just kind of, it was an insulting thing. I had to have it kind of explained to me as a child, but it's something that stuck with me. And it stuck with a lot of people. There was a big backlash against Disney, and they did end up changing that lyric in the home video. And 27 years later, they were able at least to try to address some of the other cultural insensitivities.
Of course, we've heard that when Disney was casting the film, as we often hear when it comes to casting diverse films, there were reports that the studio was struggling to cast Aladdin and Jasmine. What did you make of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's no surprise when you're working within the Hollywood system and you automatically expect to have an A-list household name in a movie, then that kind of rules out just about every actor of color, at least every brown actor or Middle Eastern actor. So you know, it was no surprise that they were struggling with that. But I think a lot of people said, forget about it. Just do what's right. I mean, when they started to talk about how much of a struggle it was, I think a lot of people felt like they were just kind of leaking that information maybe to protect themselves from inevitably whitewashing the cast as they did with Prince of Persia. But to their credit, I think that they did a stellar job and the effort paid off.
You know, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the bigger picture for actors and roles for Middle Eastern and North African actors in Hollywood. How have the sort of stereotypes evolved and or gotten better or worse generally?
Well, I mean, they've certainly gotten better, and I think they've gotten better really quickly, because for the first just about century of Hollywood, they were pretty negative. I mean, we can go back to the silent era, and you start to see these tropes starting to take starting to emerge. Then these are the sort of lecherous sheiks and the harem maidens who are sirens, or they're oppressed women, and this kind of just continues on until the 70s. Then we start to see the Muslim fundamentalist or Arab terrorist trope. And that kind of dominates stories about Middle Eastern, North African, and even South Asian stories for the next few decades. Only after 9/11 did we start to see a little bit more pushback, and it's largely coming from, you know, from the actors themselves, the audiences, and having more representation in the writers' rooms as well.
You also have a distant relative whose name is Frank Lactine, who was born in Lebanon and made his way to Hollywood. Tell us a little bit about him and the roles that he played.
Yeah, Frank was, I think it's safe to say, the first Arab movie star. He was a silent era star. He was discovered accidentally in a crowd. He was he just had this extremely distinct face. The ways that people, the early Hollywood press, would describe it is kind of morbid. They would describe it as like cadaverous looking and wolfish and basilic. And he had this ethnic ambiguity, too. You couldn't really tell what he was. So he fulfilled early Hollywood's need for ethnic villains. And so over his early career, he played, you know, bad Arabs, but also, you know, bad Chinese and villainous Indians and villainous Pacific Islanders even. But he, you know, his star rose off of these very ugly tropes. And he was at one point one of the most in-demand actors of his time. He had an interesting relationship with his ancestry, I think. I've collected all these personal records and then compared them to the persona he put forward in his clippings. And he simultaneously seemed to be very proud of his ancestry, but also very insecure about his roots as well.
We noticed that there is a certain stereotype that seems to emerge in the 1970s, which is the terrorist stereotype of the Middle Eastern actors. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. You know, they started to emerge kind of a little bit early on after the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But they started to grow after the OPEC crisis and then really take off after the 1979 Iran hostage crisis, to the point where they just kind of, you know, throwing in, sprinkling a little bit of a Muslim or Middle Eastern terrorist into your, you know, into your story just became a really lazy plot device. You know, I didn't recall this or even notice this when I was a kid, but I recently went back to Back to the Future, the first one, and in the first few minutes, there's these enraged, fanatical Libyans who you know, who are trying to kill our heroes, and it's just a plot device so that they can go back to the past.
Omar Mualim is a writer and journalist, and his upcoming book is called Praying to the West. Thank you so much, Omar.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.